Good evening. Hello. I'm Trish England, and welcome to Race Talk with Trish, produced by Dave Wallen and the Racing History Project. Did you know all our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on the Racing History Project website. That's www.racinghistoryproject.com. And you, also on the Internet Archive, archive.org. We've got a really special event tonight, an Insta GTP spectacular featuring racing historian Mitch Bishop and a batch of Insta race winners to tell what it was like. In no particular order, our roundtable consists of Rob Dyson, Rick Knuck, Jeff Klein, Bryce Cobb, and Joe Vardy, all Insta GTP and GTP Lights winners. The audience, please mute your phones. Mitch is the author of the comprehensive book, IMSA 1969 to 1989, which is available on Amazon, and he's here to start us off with a brief history of a class called GTP. So, Mitch, tell us about GTP, how it started, and where it went.
Hey, thanks, Trish. This is Mitch. Welcome, everybody. Thanks for joining. Yeah, I mean, the GTP class came about, there were a couple of different factors that drove it. One was the relationship between IMSA and the ACO, the organizers of the 24 Hours of Le Mans race, which that relationship began in 1976 when the ACO invited a couple of NASCAR stock cars to race there, as well as a couple of IMSA cars. Mike Kaiser brought his Monza over there, and John Greenwood brought his tricked out Corvette over there. In fact, Greenwood recorded the fastest time on the Mulsanne straight that year. But as part of that deal, Bill France and my father, John Bishop, negotiated. They wanted some of the cars that ran at Le Mans that weren't officially classified in IMSA to come over and race at the 24 Hours of Daytona the next year. So in 1977, in January, John Rondeau brought over a couple of cars that he called Inalteras, which were built in his garage with sort of off-the-shelf parts. And they were sleek prototype cars that looked great. They sounded great. And they did well in qualifying, but I don't think either one of them finished. But the Inalteras really gave my father the idea for creating a prototype class in IMSA where, the average team to design and build their own car with off-the-shelf parts and engines and compete effectively with what were then, GTX class, 935 and so on. So the rules for the GTP class came about in 1980 after a lot of discussions with teams and a lot of work by Roger Bailey, actually. And the GTP class was just that, designed around the concept of a rule set that allowed a lot of freedom in chassis choice and engine choice. And to kind of make everybody equal, there was a simple weight and power displacement curve where you could throw, six-cylinder engines, turbocharged, non-aspirated eight-cylinder motors and compete relatively effectively. And so that's how the GTP class was born. The first real GTP car showed up in 1981. And, not many people remember it, but Del Russo Taylor actually showed up with a revised Chevron V19 with an Alfa Romeo engine at Daytona in 1981. And the car was so slow that we didn't let it run in the actual race. So he made some runs to it and actually ran in the Sebring race in March of 81. And later on that in April of 81 is when the BMW M1C debuted at Riverside with a March chassis and a 3.5-liter BMW motor. And
detail.
from then it started to gain momentum. Of course, Brian Redman won the championship that year in a Lola T600, which debuted at the race after Riverside at Laguna Seca and won the thing. So that's kind of how it all started, with a relationship with the ACO and a desire to normalize the rules between Le Mans and the IMSA series.
Neato. Thanks, Mitch. Anybody have questions out there, audience members?
This is Rick Noop. Mitch, we actually, in 1980, Jim Busby and myself had a march with a six-cylinder, and we did the Rolex 24-hour and then the Mobil 1 12 hours of Sebring. I do remember the DeRusso Taylor. Maybe you guys remember the car. It was 1980, and it was the Rusty Jones car. And Buzz had negotiated with Robin Hurd and amongst your dad and Bailey. And I think we were kind of trying to, I'm not going to say the pioneer by any means, but it clearly wasn't an M1. It was basically a car built for racing purposes only.
Yeah, and you're right. It was classified as a GTP car in 1980. It wasn't a prototype. It was built around a March chassis, and the way that Buzz talks about it, you guys couldn't keep up with the 935 at Daytona and Sebring, and so you guys stuffed a Traco Chevy V8 in it and called the thing a March M1 Chevy. And since it wasn't legal in any of us other class, so we classified it as a GTP. And just to finish that story, Buzz told me that when he brought it to Laguna Seca later that year, it scared the crap out of him, so he never raced it again and bought a 935 from Moretti on the spot.
I remember that vividly. You know, it pulled one of the A-arms out at Riverside when Brabham and him were in it. So it was clearly going through some teething, but the index of performance or power to weight wasn't doing it. I just thought I'd put that in.
Yeah, no, it's a good footnote.
Okay.
Well, that brings me to a question then. But first we'll turn to our drivers. Guys, we got to stop meeting like this. I'm so happy all of you are here. Thanks so much. When you have this many drivers who once occupied the same tracks at the same times for all those wonderful years, I'm sure you've stored up some juicy comments you'd like to unload on each other. Who wants to start? Rob? Anybody?
Well, this is Jeff Klein. I didn't get into GTP until I did my apprenticeship in GTU and then Camel Light, and then the power to weight factor. I think Pontiac Division of General Motors, that I was driving their car, they kind of got it wrong because they wanted to go with a light car with a basically small block Chevy, and the thing never got out of its own way. So I had a great view of Rob and Price going by me all the time, once every 30 or 40 minutes. So I could tell you what the back of their car looked like. We never were very competitive.
Well, when you did get GTP, what'd you get?
Well, after Camel Light with Pontiac, I went to GTP, and I drove for General Motors Pontiac Division, the Spice, started out as a 5-liter small block Chevy and ended up about 6.5 liters, but it was never very competitive. And I drove that car for 3 or 4 years. I did drive a 962 for Busby at San Antonio, and I did go to Le Mans with Silk Cut and Price saved my life there by showing me around, but unfortunately the car broke before I got in it. So it was a nice trip for nothing, but Bryce and I got some good watches for our wives, so we went into Paris.
Jeff, hey, this is Bryce. If Jeff recalls, though, we all used to talk about what we got paid versus laps completed. So in Jeff's case, he was the winner. He did no laps, and he made all the money.
Yeah, exactly. And I kept waiting for Waukesha to ask for it back. So I'm glad you and I decided. Your car broke, too, a little later. So I'm glad we decided to take off and go to Paris, because if he found me, he probably would have wanted the money back, knowing him.
Yeah, but one thing that you guys, again, this is Price, that you guys don't know, is that Jeff Klein taught us how to do what was called step drafting. And we were all tired, and we decided to get back to Paris early. And we were in, I don't know, Jeff may recall what it is, it's some kind of P-pop or little teeny tiny car with 3 or 4 horsepower. And it would only do, I don't know, 100 kilometers until Jeff showed that if you timed it just right, moving from the slow lane on the right-hand side and a car going somewhat faster past you, he could tuck in right behind him and catch a draft. Well, I was sleeping at the time, and suddenly I noticed that there was a buzzing in my ears that was far beyond anything that this car normally made. That's because the RPM of the engine exceeded its maximum amount by probably double, and that noise was enough to wake us all up. And we looked over as I opened my eyes. We weren't a car length behind this guy, and I can't say we were going that fast, but for this car, we were going fast. And it was awesome, and I can't thank Jeff enough for that time. But also, guys, and y'all out there, everybody listening, is that one of the coolest things that we got to see then, I don't think Jeff thought was so cool, but the following year I got to go back with Jag. And it was that year, Jeff, if you recall, that because of the failure, they never ever, at least in my lifetime with Jag, they never again purchased, let's say, a batch of camshafts for all 5 cars. So they would have a batch of camshafts made for each car, a batch of blocks made for each car, so that they never chose a part that would run for all the cars, because failures then could take out every car, which is what happened. We broke camshaft.
Yeah. Well, that was the year you won, though, in 90, right? Overall?
That was the next year, yeah. But when you and I were there, it was 89, right?
Right. And
was it
breaking.
This is Rob. Price, did you win in 90 or 91?
No, I won in 90, so the first year of the chicanes. You know, Rob, you know, you look back at my life with yourself and others. I mean, I was one of the lucky ones. So I got to live through bias ply tires to radials, from analog gauges to computers, from no chicanes at Le Mans to chicanes. So what can I tell you? I've been a lucky guy.
Well, you know, I was just going to say this to Jeff, but at Le Mans, Price drove me around in a streetcar, round and round and round. And then when I got in for practice, I realized that there was nothing that was the same in a streetcar as it was in a road car. And as Price said, that was the last year, 1989, before they got rid of the chicane, and we were doing in the high 240 miles an hour down the straight. And after the first practice, I remember I asked Price if he knew where John Gore's line was, because I wanted to buy some disability insurance. And when I got over to John Gore's line, Ari Leyendijk was there in front of me, because he had the same idea I did, you know, that if we die, we die. But if we get maimed, we need something to carry us the rest of our lives. So it was an interesting experience.
Well, this is Rob. This is Rob. When Price and I went over to Le Mans in 86 to ride with Richard Lloyd, our teammate was Marl Baldy, who drove approximately, I don't know, did he drive an hour of the race, and then he disappeared. And when he was taking us around, here we were, wet behind the ears, and Baldy, you know, who had a very good record at Le Mans, he was, he showed us around, and he was kind of so, it was kind of, you couldn't relate to what he was saying because it was really totally irrelevant, and he kept stopping the car and telling him, and it was the biggest bunch of gibberish. So when I got in the car the first time, I'll never forget, we had a 956, and Price says, look, Rob, this is not like our 962. Remember, the wheelbase is a lot shorter, so if you're going to hit the wall, pull your legs back.
It's good advice, you know.
It was. Fortunately, I didn't need it.
No, you wouldn't want to. This is kind of off the subject, but Price, you told me a story about the year before or 2 years before when you drove for Porsche and you had a mishap. Anyway, do you remember the story you told me? You got back to where your clothes were and stuff. I don't want to tell your story for you. So.
No. I mean, you're welcome to tell it because I forget easily. I do remember what happened. And I think Rob was there that year as well, but we weren't together. And
that's right.
It was. And Rob, I appreciate your words to me because what was I going to do? You know. So, but meanwhile, Jeff, tell the story, and then I'll jump in if it's way off base.
Well, I have a good memory, but I remember you told me that you were driving a Porsche 962, probably, and you were going through the Porsche mm-hmm. curves and crashed.
By the time you
got out of the car and they had got you back to the pits, everything about you was gone. They had removed all your personal possessions, your driving suits, your helmets, everything. They kind of canceled you.
Is that true? I believe, Jeff, it was the beginning of the current cancel culture. I was the first guy.
Yeah.
but Rob, I can't thank you for your words. I was written off, but well, I think they felt it was equal penance because I just wrote off one of their cars. Now let's all admit that if Hans Stuck hadn't written one of theirs off the day before at Weissach, before they came down, or maybe it was 2 days before, they would have had an armada of cars there that they always did. But after I wrote one off in practice, they only had two left. Now, they still went on to win, as dominant as that car was back in the day. But at Rob's suggestion, I hung around, and I think I got into Richard Lloyd's car. So
that's right,
you know,
exactly.
James Weaver. Yeah, it was good.
Exactly. And the funny thing about this, Price shows up. He says, how's the car? Are you all right? He says, well, I'm currently not very busy right now, and related to me that they had the cancel culture. I mean, I was flabbergasted. I mean, all of his garb, race garb, everything, all the Porsche Rothmans stuff. Rothmans, was it, Price?
Yes.
Was Rothmans their big sign? And all of that stuff was gone. And I said, well, as long as you get, at least did they take your underwear, I think I might have said. But anyway, the Porsche guys always took Le Mans really seriously. If they did no other race, they did that one. And that's been their history, and it still continues. But I'll tell you, the you talk about all racing with all these guys. The one great thing about running with all of these guys that are on the broadcast tonight is that everybody was actually fairly good. We were all about the same age. But the other thing is that we never really, in those days, you passed someone. You didn't slam them. You didn't run up against them. You didn't jam them. Because in those days, you're just as liable to write your car off as you or get hurt as you would have done that with anybody else. And the whole kind of competition, we were running the cars hard. But at the same time, there was an element of kind of chivalry, I guess, that, hey, there's a time and a place to pass, and there's you never wanted to hang anybody out to put them at risk. And all of these guys that were on the call were exemplary in that. There was never any fear of being able to run with these guys at high speeds on the banking at Daytona or Lime Rock or going anywhere at the Riverside or anywhere. You didn't have to worry about getting these guys putting you in trouble. And that kind of thing is, I think it's a little bit changed now. They've seen that the cars are built better, they're built safer, and it was great to compete with these guys. And when we got done with the racing, we were all friends.
That's true. You know, Rob, don't you think that the fact that the current cars don't have a manual transmission, you have the paddle shifts, it takes about 80% of the opportunity to brake out of the equation. As I know,
I agree with you. I think the art of shifting clutch, brake, gear shift, I think that was an art in and of itself. And that did separate the guys that finished and the guys that didn't, or the guys that went a little bit faster because they could just work the mechanics of the automobile.
Yeah.
And nowadays it, they only touch the clutch when they're coming in and out of the pits. The rest of the time they got the paddle. And the paddle is all sequenced with the wheel speed, so they could go from sixth to first before they get to a turn. But it doesn't shift until the wheel speed, and then it starts running through the gears, and the wheel speed slows up. So that you're right. There's no doubt that that's affected us.
It's like a pre-selector gearbox on a 1930 Bentley. You know, it doesn't shift
right.
until you slow down enough.
That's right.
Price, you drove a lot of contemporary cars, didn't you? You're a lot younger than Rob and I, so I think you hung on longer. What's the latest car you drove?
Not as much as you think.
Yeah, I woke up one day, and I don't want to ostracize the whole conversation because I know that Rick and Joe are out there, and I want to hear from them. But, you know, I was one of the lucky ones. I say that in all. You know, I don't know how else to say it, but I woke up one day and realized that I'd had the run that I wanted in racing, and I didn't need to do it anymore. And that sounds crappy, but I had a family and other things that I wanted to do. So I was lucky in that it was the same as if you flipped a light switch. I went from full bore, couldn't wait to do it, you know, put every piece, every ounce of energy I had into it, to literally the next day I was done emotionally. I was just done. So in many ways, I consider myself lucky. Again, you know, thank you, Rob. Thank you, Tom Walkinshaw. Thank you, Mazda and Chevrolet and all the people that I got to race for. I had a good run. And again, what can I say? I was a lucky man.
Yeah. Well, I think you're 10 years younger than I am. I was born in 44.
I'm 66.
Yeah, I'm 77. So.
Yeah.
But I still drive vintage cars. I still love racing. I don't know. I still enjoy it. So, I mean, obviously, vintage cars, there's no pressure or any of the pressure we got to try, you know, because if you get paid to drive, you have to win. And now driving vintage cars, I still get paid a little bit, but, you know, winning's not the major thing, although I still like to win. But everybody's different, you know. I mean, my daughter's 48, so I don't have a young family.
Well, hey, what about is Joe Vardy here? Hello?
I don't know. Dave, is Joe there?
No, Joe couldn't make it. He sent me a text saying something else is going on, probably driving home in some racetrack. I don't know.
Oh, sorry about that.
For him, that's entirely possible.
Yeah, I just wanted to visit with him. And hey, Rick, this is Price.
Hey, hi, Price. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Say, a couple things I always wanted to ask you about, because you were basically kicking butt before I came around. And things that I thought were so cool, and correct me if I'm wrong, didn't you drive, you start out at Le Mans in a I don't know what they called it back then, a P2 car, and then you went on to drive the P1 cars?
I mean, Well, I tell you, my first year in the IMSA series was 1978, and I drove a Jim Busby prepared car with Steve Earle, who you all know from the historic car racing, and Bob Aiken. And we were vintage car racers, and we Earle and Aiken bought the George Dyer, that Mexico blue with the yellow scallops. It was a beautiful car back in the RSR days. But my first time at Le Mans, you guys, was with Busby and Chris Cord. And we drove with the Kramer brothers, Manfred and Irwin, and it was a 935. So I was 24 years old, and we had a great go at it. Busby seemed to watch my consistency and all that stuff, and I was just elated to be part of a, you know, the Kramer brothers. My goodness, that was like going to Yankee Stadium at that time. I mean, that was almost a full-blown factory, semi-works effort. And we ended up six overall. And I share with you guys the thrill of that straightaway. Crap, it was almost 4 miles long, open-face helmets. It was a 935, kind of generic looking. But we just kept going and going and going. And then the next year, which is the only, I've been to Le Mans twice, was, you're right, it was Group C2. It was Camel Lights in the U.S., but it was Group C2 in Europe, Mazda Lola. So, Price, I share with you and Klein a lot of the Mazda efforts starting back with GTU and Dave Kent. So I've been there twice, and both times it was that kind of wild, wallowing sound halfway down that high crown Mulsanne of, you know, when those cars, you just, you're in it, and you're in it, and you're in it, and you're painfully aware you're hauling ass. So that was pretty much it. And then I was lucky enough to Price and Rob run against you guys at, you know, in the 962s. And I've got a short but fast story. I think you guys will all remember when the IMSA crew went to Charlotte, North Carolina, and it was before our colleague Jim Downing has a Hans device. I gotta tell you what, I've driven NASCAR and Pikes Peak and all. I have never had more side loads, sprint cars included, then going through that turn three and four at Charlotte in that cereal bowl angle of it. It was like doing steep turns in a P-51. And we did it lap after lap. So Buzz and I looked at each other like a bobblehead and said, how in the crap are we going to keep our necks supported? So remember the old Goodyear driving suits with the Epilex? He went flying into town in the rental car and got some surgical tubing and said, try this one on, Noop. And that was our first version of kind of a tethered Charlotte race. But I think all of us on the phone were there at that track. I don't know what your thoughts were, but we were lucky enough to finish pretty well there. But Lord have mercy, halfway through three and four, if anything were to break, we would have been like a big fly swatter.
All I remember about one of those, I think we raced there twice.
Yeah.
Did we race, how many times did we race there, Price? Was it twice?
That's like I said, I recall twice, but that's it.
Yeah, I think IMSA was there three or four times because I remember doing it in GTU car a couple of times and then Camel Light in 85, but I don't think we went back after that.
Yeah,
I'm
you,
not sure.
Remember this? This is Mitch. Remember, it was the near the home of Camel Cigarettes, RJR, right? And so they did this promotion where they would give anybody buying a carton of Camels a free ticket to the race. So that's why the stands were always so packed.
Ah,
yeah. I love it. Hey, Go ahead.
This is Rick again. I think I know what the years were because I went there when I was with the Toyota factory in 82 and then for sure in 85. So you guys can fill the rest in. But those are my two visits there. And I just thought for us on the phone that were, and Rob, you're so correct. I think life was dear to us then because we were basically sitting in an aluminum tub. And I couldn't agree with you anymore, Rob. We were awfully accurate, good traffic decisions, because those cars under impact, we lost a few of my heroes, or all of our heroes, Beloff and those. I mean, it was, what a tribute to Porsche. I mean, my God, the thing was just it was a joy to drive. But I think we all can agree we had utmost respect for what could happen. That little story about Charlotte, I figured it, but I believe we were there in 82 and 85, and that's it from me right now.
Yeah, I think 85, and the one thing I remember about 85 is Bob Aiken was pushed slightly aside. I can't remember what happened, but he got pushed slightly aside and hit the inside of that wall going into the infield. And that car was literally destroyed, and by golly, Bob got out of the car unscathed. That car was really badly bent, and boy, it was a relief because it was a complete screw-up. I think he got pushed a little bit sideways. I think it was John Paul riding in, I can't remember what car. It might have been Phil Connie's Buick powered March. But it was not anything intentional. But Bob, well, I remember that car was literally hurt.
Hey guys,
yeah,
this is Mitch.
I
want to ask you guys
82
a
to 86,
It's either 85 or 86. I can't remember.
Yeah,
either 85 or 86.
Yeah, we raced there 82 to 86, and then in 2000, they went back and did an American Le Mans Series race there. Thank God for racing sports cars, right? It has all the info. But
hey, guys, this is Mitch. Just to change the subject for a bit, but also talking about track. One of the things about IMSA that a lot of the drivers that I talked to really liked was the fact that we ran on tracks like Charlotte and purpose-built road courses, but also street courses. And maybe you guys can tell us, what were your favorite courses to race on and why?
Oh, boy. This is Rob. My favorite racetrack was and still is Watkins Glen. It's got all the ingredients you want. It's got great sweeping turns, nice straightaways, plenty of room, good speed. The worst one was, and Price, remember that West Palm Beach race that we did, where they were running us through this stupid parking lot. And I remember Wallach was way ahead of everybody, and under the yellow, everybody got bunched up, and he was bitching about it, and he ultimately crashed. But Price was running there, and I can't remember, some lights car flipped and went over Price and landed and wrecked our rear tail. So we had to borrow a tail from Holbert. And he said, look, if I need it, I'm going to take it back from you. And I said, well, that's okay, because if you need it, you're probably going to be in the side of the road anyway. But that was a track where we literally were going among the dividers in a commercial parking lot.
Yeah,
that was the worst experience.
I know there was a hairpin. That was 87, and they had that Mickey Mouse track, and the hairpin they had was so tight that there wasn't enough steering radius. And the first practice session, if you remember, someone couldn't make the turn because they didn't have enough steering radius, and everyone was backed up behind it. It was like a valet parking lot. It was ridiculous. Then we went to the fairground after that the next year, which actually wasn't that bad a track.
Yeah, the fairground was different. This was the one that was in that parking lot thing, and that was
they only ran that once, I think. But I like San Antonio, but I mean, I think everyone likes Elkhart Lake also, Watkins and Elkhart Lake. I like San Antonio road course. I thought, or street course. I thought that was a lot of fun. Interesting
yeah, this
place.
Is Frank. I, without question, my most enjoyable times were behind the wheel at a street race. And that doesn't mean that I don't like long tracks, far from it. You know, Watkins Glen, Elkhart Lake, Laguna, VIR, although I never drove a prototype there. I love those tracks, but I don't know, because when I was a kid, I grew up racing Formula Atlantic cars and smaller cars and many street races across Canada and the United States. So I just enjoyed it. And maybe it was the disease in my brain that makes you want to drive something that if you make a mistake, you're done, meaning the car is completely written off 9 times out of 10. I know that's sick. I'll leave a funny with you guys. I was at Long Beach 1 year in a Formula Atlantic car, and I thought I had it just right. And I, y'all might remember, I don't remember the names of the roads, but we actually had to go uphill to some road, turn right, go down that road, then turn right again and go back down the hill. And
sure,
I was going up the hill, turning right, and I back then on bi-supply tires, you did a lot of pitching, you know, sort of driving the car, backing it in like a sprint car. And the only problem was with this effort of mine, one of my more brilliant moves, I ripped the right front suspension off, apexing the corner. Well, of course, that didn't leave the car in good stead that moment after. So we had another one, went back to the pits, thought about it. I got it. Went back out and did exactly the same thing in the same spot. I was a big girl. But I still like street racing, so there you go.
Yeah, I thought
well,
the one out of the car.
What's that?
You needed to take the gremlin out of the car before you got back in it.
Yeah. Well, it's like a second shot in a golf game. You know, you God, I know I shouldn't have sliced that ball. Give me another one, and you put it exactly the same place, which generally means you lost two balls instead of just one.
You know. accurately disgusting.
You know, IMSA was kind of funny. There are a couple places we went to just once. This is Jeff. Like Topeka, Kansas, the track there that used part of the drag racing thing. And then I remember went up a hill in a big sweeping turn. It was kind of a fun track. And I think we only went back there once. And
Halifax, we did a race up at Halifax. That was only a one shot. They wanted to do one in Michigan, not at the speedway in Michigan. But I'll tell you, we did a couple races in New Orleans. That was later. It was still
that 91 when we did it in that rainstorm.
Oh,
that was horrible.
That was awful. I couldn't believe they ran it as long as they did.
Yeah, and it's, you know, the track was just all squared off corners, like you were driving, you know, I mean, the chase scene in the Thomas Crown Affair had better, you know, open track than New Orleans.
That's okay. I enjoyed that race too. The biting.
I didn't visualize that.
Say again.
I'll tell you the saddest thing. If you this is Robbie, you take a look at the motor racing history. The saddest thing with I think one of the greatest tracks, and Price and I did real well there. The first time I ever saw it was Riverside, and we ran it in 86, and it was the full course, way up in the back and coming down at a long straightaway and everything. And I got to admit, Chris, my son was running the Pirelli World Challenge. We were doing a demo program in Long Beach, and we left and drove up to Paris so Chris could run his sprint car. and Paris is just right, just on the other side of Riverside, there isn't a marker, there isn't one, not the slightest hint. One of the greatest racetracks that ever existed, Riverside, was there's not a hint on an historic marker that it even existed.
Wow.
It was really kind of sad how it's kind of sifted, kind of, you know, just in a race, like a some kind of, you know, town that just got blown away.
But, yeah, someone's got a picture where they took the track, a picture of it now, you know, Google Earth or whatever, and then overlaid the track over it. And you're right, Rob, they didn't even use any of the turns, you know, for streets there or anything. The whole place is just obliterated.
Ironically,
Nissan there when they had half the track ripped up and you could go from turn six all the way back to turn nine. I tested for Clayton there, and that was about the end of it. That had to be like 89 or 90, and then it just disappeared after that. It's a shame.
Ironically, Bridgehampton, which is kind of I never saw an IMSA race, but Bridgehampton, they're still used part of the racetrack for golf carts at this golf course that was built right on where the track is. They still use remnants of the track around as part of the golf where people run their golf carts. So it's not completely obliterated. And actually, they have a lot of pictures hanging up in the clubhouse of old Bridgehampton.
Yeah, here
Andy,
where
but
I
you know, we actually ran at Bridgehampton in 71.
Really?
Oh, did you, Mitch?
Yeah, 71 or 72, I can't remember, but that was one of the last races there, I think.
Wow.
Well, no, I think they stopped around 82. I think 82 they stopped, 82 or 83. They stopped racing. It was a fabulous racetrack. Not much in the way of amenities at the track, however, which was true of a lot of racetracks in the old days.
Still true here if you go to Willow Springs in California. That place is still desolate, you know. The wind will be blowing in your face, and you have a foot of rain in your, you know, on your feet. So that's a horrible place all year long, but it's a neat racetrack.
Chris says Chris did a lot of testing out there, and he said that every lap is, depending on the wind, if it's really windy, the track changes every lap.
Yeah.
Have any of y'all driven at Utah?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, we raced.
I don't think they had a professional race, did they, Rob? Were you going to say?
We did several American Le Mans races there, and then we did the Pirelli World Challenge there as well. And that track was designed by Alan Wilson, and when we got out there, Alan sought me out. He says, come on, I want you to drive. It's a brand-new racetrack. He laid it out, and I've never been so confused going around a racetrack. I said, Alan, how many turns do you have here? He said, we have 26 turns. In 3.5 miles. I said, Alan, you sure you got enough turns? And so when they started racing the first time, they actually changed the configuration of the track from Friday to Saturday to Sunday, eliminating corners because everybody was getting so friggin' confused. It was the most – and then ultimately they started taking just one set – line and made it kind of a more normal racetrack, but that was a racetrack built by the
Ford dealer.
And he owned Larry
Miller.
Anyway, Miller, yeah. Larry Miller, and he owned the Utah Jazz. He owned the minor league team, and a lot of car dealers and a couple radio stations there. Delightful guy, ultimately died of complications of diabetes, but they spared no expense. That pit area and the paddock area was just beautiful. I don't know what they're doing with it now.
Well, the state owns it now, and they rent it to an operator, and they still have races there. I drove a vintage race there in Janetta a couple of years ago, and you're absolutely right. I mean, the first time you go out there, and because it's a desert, I mean, there's no trees, there's nothing to use as kind of bookmarks. So you don't know where the hell you're at.
Well, in that first season, they had a couple of races that were like 12 hours and stuff, and it'd get dark. Are there no lights out there? What do you do in the dark?
Well, I mean, we ran night races at Willow, and there's no lights, and at Riverside. So Chris Cord and I both ran our first professional race at Riverside in an IMSA race, a six-hour race in 1975. And I think it started at 3 in the afternoon and finished at 9 o'clock at night. And we were driving a obsolete Ferrari Daytona, and they had the factory Batmobile CSLs there from BMW. I think they won with Redmond and Greg and Sam Posey. And it was kind of an interesting, fun race for both Chris and I think.
That obsolete Ferrari is probably worth about $50 million.
Yeah, it's an aluminum body. They call it a CFAC, so it was a factory race car. Yeah, but I didn't own it, and neither did Chris. Some guy named Ken Starbird owned it, so we wouldn't have benefited anyway. I couldn't have afforded one of the tires at the time. Probably still can't.
Oh, let me do a station identification, y'all. Hang on. This is Race Talk with Trish, produced by Dave Wallen and the Racing History Project. All our shows are recorded. Thank you. Where was I? You can listen to them forever on the Racing History Project. www.racinghistoryproject.com or the archive.org. Thank you. Carry on. Everybody there?
So Price. Yeah.
Yes.
Price, I always wanted to ask you, how did you ever hook up with Rob Dyson?
Well, it's an interesting story, and
I believe
a good one.
Sense, but, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, nice guy. Jeff, only you would say that. Anyway, when I got out of high school, I thanked my parents for a wonderful life because I was leaving. I was going to go racing one way or the other. And they said, hey, humor us. For us, will you go to the Bob Bondurant driving school? And, of course, as a punk kid, you think, what am I going to learn there? But, of course, it was the best thing that ever happened to me. Not only because it shortened my learning curve, that things that I'm sure most of us would have picked up eventually. It would have taken me longer than anyone else, but nonetheless, Bondurant and his crew, taught me things that just, again, got me up to speed or some semblance of speed. So, but I got to meet Rob there, and Rob, what can I say? I appreciate the time from that day on that we had together, and years later, Rob and I joined up, and I was, had a great time. So that was it.
So he
was
at the class of the same as you did, same time.
Believe it or not, that was kind of you talk about a little piece of racing history. When Price and I were on Ontario Motor Speedway, and it was the last week. And as we were leaving, it was a 5-day school. As we were leaving, mid afternoon. On Friday, the wrecking trucks were pulling in to start tearing the place down.
Yeah.
And as that thing was going in the rearview mirror, it was obliterated in about 3 weeks after that.
That's bad.
And actually, what was also interesting about it is that, Bob Bondurant's driving school, Bob Bondurant was instructing. I mean, he was there most of the time. So it was really, really quite an experience, really, a little racing history, really.
Well, in 1971 at Ontario, they had the Questor Grand Prix. You remember that? They had the Formula One.
Formula One against 5,000. Yeah.
So they had a race before, a support race for Formula Fords. So I was in it, and I started eighth or ninth, and won the race, and never passed a soul. Everyone crashed in front of me, and I ended up winning the race. So I thought, well, this has got to be like Monaco or like Macau. I'm going to stay here until one of these Formula One guys come over and ask me for my information, because clearly I have the talent to do that. And I'm leaning against my Chevy station wagon with my Formula Ford on an open trailer waiting until the sun went down. Of course, no one ever came, but that's always how I remember Ontario Motor Speedway. I miscalculated again,
I've often wondered who the promoter of that thing was, because I don't know. He had a roster of Formula One cars, and he had all the 5,000 cars, and he had all the F1 guys were there. I mean, it was Tyrrell and McLaren and all these other guys were there. So I don't know how the promoter
paid him a lot of money, huh? Whoever
must
was.
Have.
Yeah.
I wonder who actually promoted that. I'm gonna have to look that. I'm gonna have to ask around and see who did that.
Yeah.
That was a long time ago.
That was 1971. Yeah.
Yeah. That was, long, that was a while
that was
ago.
My fifth year racing already. I remember when I went to Le Mans with Price, and I think Walkinshaw and Tony Dow thought I was a lot younger than I was. I was 45 years old then. And Walkinshaw said, looking at my resume, after I'm already there, and he goes, "Bloody hell," he goes, "you're as old as I am." I had a laugh about that. I think he thought that he might as well get back in the car if he's hiring guys that are as old as he is,
all fun.
That was a hell of a program while it was going, though.
Yeah, well, that was the only time I was involved, but I know Price was incredibly successful doing that, and he should be. I mean, it was a pretty cool deal.
Trish,
was Brundle the number one driver on that team, Price?
Rob, good question. I don't really know, because I, as an American, I was really more tied in with Tony Dow. And so it was the American Jaguar team against the actual English. And it was quite humorous to sit back and watch Tony Dow cause grief to the English people. And Tony, of course, is an English person. So we used to stand around and chuckle, not knowing what drove him to do this. So he had some reason to aggravate them no end. But to answer your question, I don't know if Martin, clearly he figured in the thing. So the 1990, Eliseo Salazar was meant to drive the car with myself and John Nielsen, but Eliseo, they never allowed him into the car because once three drivers, as you guys know, back then anyway, once three drivers have been in the car, that's the only three that will ever get in the car. So it was John Nielsen and I, until Sunday sometime when Brundle's car had broken down, but they could see that we might have a shot at winning, and they thought they should put Brundle into the car because here was an English chap winning in the English car. And, to me, Rob, I was never a politician. I thought it was all kind of ridiculous, and I still say to this day, come on, guys, we're not curing cancer. This is for fun. This is entertainment. So I don't understand some of the stuff that went on. I thought it would have been great to see Eliseo in the car. But anyway, not my car, not my choice. I know it's a long-winded answer, Rob. I don't really know if Martin was number one.
He was pretty good, though.
No question.
He was pretty good.
No question. What can I say? Go ahead.
Do you remember those races we had at Delmar? At the Delmar racetrack? Remember those things? I was just thinking about them.
loved it. You remember when James decided that they were complaining, they being the officials, were complaining about the noise of your twin turbocharged six-cylinder P-Popper Porsche, was supposedly louder than Wayne Taylor's Chevy V8. And they told you guys to come in because I guess in California they had that kind of power to stop people. And James, wink, wink, accidentally hit the sound meter. Little did he know it was connected to a guy's head. Now nobody got hurt, but I'm sure he got ear. His ears were burning from the speed of the hearing device coming off his ears. But sometimes you wonder about the fallacy of these things. So, you know, somebody's holding, any human standing by the track would have said that Chevy was loudest by far. But its timbre didn't register the same as a twin-turbo, three-cylinder on each side Porsche. Because then I think, Rob, you had the liquid-cooled motor in, right? You guys had moved far enough along down the road that...
Yeah, it was a water-cooled car. And the thing was, is that it was where they had the sound microphone picking up the sound was on the side of the racetrack, and our exhaust came right out the side of the car.
That's right. But still.
You know, I mean, we were running first, and the car was good, and that was in the days of the Camel Pyramid money, when, you know, it kept escalating, kind of like a skins game in golf, and it kept escalating, and because we were pulled out of that thing, had we won that race, I think we would have run almost $200,000. And in those days, as it is now, but in those days, that was really big, big money for sports car racing. Right. And that was heartbreaking, that thing. That really pissed me off, that whole deal. But James did everybody a favor by dismantling that stuff. Because that was total bullshit. And that was Chris Booth. Chris Booth should have mitigated that.
I mean, there were Mazda Camel light cars running. It's hard to believe your car would be louder than one of those.
Exactly. The fallacy.
But their exhaust, Jeff, their exhaust came out the back. And so, you know, wherever they had it located, the microphone, it was right near the ground. And, you know, every time it went by, I mean, if you're 3 inches away from the exhaust of a fully revved lawnmower engine, it would have broken the rules.
Yeah.
Hey, Rob, do you remember the story of James getting called in after that for doing what he did? Do you remember that story?
Vaguely. So,
I only remember
you were there.
James told him. Yeah, well, I was there, but not in prototypes, I don't think, that year. But anyway, I could have been. I forget these things. Age gives me great gifts. Anyway, so Bob Aiken was there, apparently pleading for James, had him convinced James it was a complete accident. No sooner does he finish saying that, James comes and says, "I'm sorry, I did it on purpose." So, you know, I was just feeling for Bob Aiken after he tried his level best to get James off the hook, and James completely ratted himself out.
Yeah, they were going to find James. They were going to find James and pull his license and everything. Yep. And James just smiled, and no money changed hands. Unfortunately, no money changed hands with our being able to run the race either. So, you know.
Crap.
That was a heartbreaker, that one.
Still, still an interesting place to race, you know. And again, I know that some of you guys don't like this kind of tracks, but to me, it's another supreme technical challenge. Do you guys remember the year they sprayed that track sealer down on the top of the surface of the road? And during the yellow flags, our tires would pull this stuff up off the ground. Do you remember that at all?
Yeah.
It was unbelievable. And then to get it off and race again. Oh, and also, if you recall, this was, you know, and I say this with no disrespect to anybody making rules, because that's tough, you know, and when you have many teams and legions of engineers trying to figure out how to get around the rules. The rules makers are automatically in a tough situation, but I think it was where somebody was complaining about how low everybody's running their cars. Although I saw in prototype racing, who cares, right? I mean, it's your choice, in my opinion. But Jaguar, in their infinite wisdom, came up with, I'm sure others too, but I only saw the Jag side of it, that when you came into the pits, you had to cross over something or stop, and they would look to see that your car measured a certain height off the ground. So the Jaguar guys had this thing that raised the car up off the ground about 4 or 5 inches on purpose. So it was stupid, like in your face, but that also happened at Del Mar. So I know there's no real segue into that, but I just remember oddball things like that. And, of course, it failed on the Jaguar, and the car got in big trouble one time. But, I mean, it's just memories like that for me are quite enjoyable.
Well, you know, the nowadays, it used to be that the car guys and the entrants knew more than the sanctioning body about virtually everything. Nowadays, the sanctioning bodies have taken over by making sure, well, it's all electronic now. There's nothing mechanical, so it's all electronic, and they're providing you with all the electronics. So you can't even screw around with the electronics, although I'm sure there are teams that have tried, but you can't screw around the electronics, and that's enabled them to do this balance of performance where, you know, the Mazda wins one week and the Cadillac wins another and the Honda wins another. I mean, it's just, it has taken a lot of the fun out of it because part of our deal, Price, remember this. I mean, we put crap on our 962 bodywork. We put stuff on there. We didn't know whether it worked or not. We just put it on there just to see, just to tweak it. We kind of thought it might work. We didn't know whether it worked. We didn't have any wind tunnel, and we weren't going to run it down Main Street of Poughkeepsie, so where the shop was. So we didn't know, but we thought, well, let's try this, let's try that. And people were looking at us, and sometimes they'd copy our stuff, and the front wing, if you wanted to get more downforce on a street race, you put a kind of a rinky-dink front wing right on the nose. I mean,
do that a lot, I think. I remember seeing your car with the big wing in the front, which I'm sure
we
worked.
We did, and it worked.
Yeah.
It did work.
at the risk of sounding like an old fogey, one of the things I hate about modern racing is that they penalize people for hitting each other. And, both in IndyCar and in IMSA now, if you, cause someone to spin or, do something, I think it kind of ruins the whole thing. I think, back when we were running, you'd hit people and stuff by accident or whatever. If it was on purpose, you knew it was going to get back at you, so you didn't do it. But I don't know. It just takes something out of it, to have these drive-through penalties. But it sounds like no one agrees with me, but that's okay.
No, hey, Frank again. Yeah,
I agree.
Go ahead. I agree. At the same token, though, Jeff, I mean, the cars are so much more bulletproof today that back then we were self-policing because if you chose, like if I chose to hit you, I'd be taking a huge risk myself, whereas today,
correct,
it's almost irrelevant. You can get away with it. But, Rob, you remember that year, I think it was West Palm, when AJ got taken out, or in his mind, he got taken out by Lorari in the Broom Porsche.
Absolutely.
He sat on the side of the road with the car in first gear, max revs, waiting for Lorari to show up. And he set the car off like a missile to spear him. That was probably not the right thing to do.
that was when it was at the fairgrounds, so it was really kind of a better racetrack. But you're right. I mean, he spun out the wrong guy, but I can tell you that you're right. I mean, nowadays the cars are built stronger. They're by design, they're made heavier, and with all the carbon, carbon frames and carbon tubs and all the structure around, the safety structure is really good. So you can cause a lot of damage and not get your ass handed to you. In our day, you would get your ass handed to you. And that was one of the things that was really significant about it. That's why I think, you know, we all ran hard, but we were just careful, as I mentioned earlier.
Yeah. I just think it's part of racing that you're in a fight with someone or whatever, and, you know, you nudge someone out of the way or something like that. And now, you know, they do that. I don't know. I was watching the race last week, wherever the heck they were. Where were they last week? Laguna Seca. And I don't know, a couple of the, you know, the GT cars kind of touched each other. One guy just kind of was on the brakes a little too late and ran into one guy and spun him. And, you know, they had him, you know, drive through the pits. It just kind of over the top. I don't, you know, but that's just my opinion. And no one asked me, so I won't.
Well, it's a matter of degrees. That's what it amounts to. It's a matter of degrees. Yeah. And, you know, they. I think in some ways they take it a little bit too far. But in other ways, they don't take it far enough. I mean, you know, it's a fine line, but we couldn't act stupid, because if we did, we could have gotten hurt ourselves.
Yeah.
Hey, guys, I hate to be a Doug Downer here, but I got to run. But I've enjoyed it thoroughly. Trish, thank you.
Oh, it's been marvelous. Thank you so much.
And I'll see some of you guys. All right.
Price, I'll see you next week.
Yeah, Jeff, you too, right?
Yeah, John Paul Singh, I'll see you.
Yes.
Be nice.
Right, good deal, man.
And Rick, take care.
Rick, you coming?
Okay, hi, Brighton. I'm going to be in Pontiac, Michigan, unfortunately, for the American Speed Festival with Jim Hall.
Oh, and, yeah, that's a big deal. That's an adjunct to the Detroit Auto Show.
It certainly
is.
That's a big deal.
That's going to be a big deal.
I've been instructing there. Whenever Johnny O'Connell doesn't, and it's quite a facility. If you guys that are still on the phone, and I hope to see you, Price, soon.
Okay. Take care, everybody.
All right, Price, take care.
Just a little bit of insight, you guys. Unfortunately, I'm just sick that I can't go to John Paul's program, but there's a few of us that can't because it's, as you know, Rob, and everyone, the with this pandemic thing, whether it's right or wrong, indifferent, they didn't have the 2020 Motorsports Hall of Fame inductees. And what they've done there is they've got a brand new building, which they're going to debut, and they're going to have the class of 2020 and 2021. And then also, as part of the Woodward Speed Festival, the Woodward Boulevard, they're also doing an American Speed Festival, in which they have Jim Hall and the iconic Chaparrals coming. So I'm sort of tied in with them I go out there every couple of months, and I'm just sick. I can't go and give the respect. It's going to be at Joey Cavallari's, as you know, and or at the Van Nuys Airport. It's going to be a super event, and I hope to catch you guys later, but unfortunately I'll be in Michigan.
Yeah.
Hey, well, I've got kind of a fast story about the 962 and stuff, and I just thought I would tell you the thrill. And Jim Busby, as most of you know, I've been with for years, since 1978, but I just wanted to tell you the thrill of when the Lufthansa unloaded the cars at LAX, and they arrived at the Laguna Beach shop, which Jim has had there since the RSR days, so that would be going back to 74. But for me to go up from the GTU, GTO, GTX, and then to see those cars in the darkness, I turned all the lights off and I stepped.
Recorded.
The one thing that I'll never forget is clicking the ignition just one time, and almost the light show inside. I mean, Porsche, you guys must admit they really finished cars off. And the Lufthansa tape was on, and they were in the the Porsche White before we got Youngblood, and Jim's always had the liveries that we all seem to give a judge's nod, and the cars were fast. But I just wanted to tell you, as a guy that's driven quite a few different categories of cars, that when the GTP cars and Mitch's dad and Mark Raffoff and all those, it was just really a special moment that I'll cherish forever.
Yeah, you can't beat the Bishops. They were nice people, you know.
Well, in those days, it was. I had an interesting conversation with Ray Hall not too long ago, and we were talking, and he says, look, the entrants know more than any of the people running the sanctioning bodies. And I said to him, I said, Bobby, there's one exception to that. He said, what's that? I said, John Bishop, when he was running IMSA. And Bobby said, you're right. His judgment on how to do it was better than any other sanctioning body. And he was perceptive, smart, and paid attention to the details.
And you know what? He rarely pissed anyone off. I mean, I don't know anyone that ever had a problem with him. He's such a nice person, and thanks to IMSA. I think we were lucky enough to be in IMSA. I'd like to think in the golden era of racing, you know, when there were 150,000 people show up at Riverside to watch an IMSA race, you know, and I mean, it was fun and it was great racing. So I think we were been able to be in it.
Yeah, you had a great staff of people that were all knowledgeable, but they wanted you out on the racetrack. They wanted to make sure that you got out and competed.
And then also, how about Charlie Rainbill?
But, you know, what the heck?
Yeah. I'll tell you one thing. I think John was such a mild-mannered but a man on a mission. And if you ever did get into trouble in the principal's office, guess who we all saw? Charlie Rainbill. So I made darn sure that Charlie and I were pretty good buddies. It was an all-star cast, and Mitch, I got to tell you what, I'm just going to piggyback on what Rob's saying and what Jeff's saying and all of us. It was an honor to be part of that, and the glory years, holy crap, Riverside packed them in, you're right. So that was just a little brief thing I thought I would say when those white 962s came to Laguna Beach. I just said, oh, my God, showtime. And that's just a little bit of how I got mesmerized and a guy that's seen a lot of race cars.
If you see those cars at a vintage car event, you sit back and say, even today, saying, man, those things are really right. They are really, really right.
They're right. That's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
You know, I was lucky enough to drive those cars, GTP cars, you know, up until about 2010, because there was a guy named Mark Pritch who bought three GTP cars, two Camel Lights. One of them was the Acura Camel Light car, and the other was the one that Tommy Kendall drove and Wayne Baker, not the Intrepid, but the Last Spice with a 400 cubic inch Chevy in it. And we would run them in these HSR 3-hour events, and we'd have like EFR and Morton and a guy, Gary Pearson, would come over from England, and there were, I don't know, like five or six of us, but we'd have three cars to drive, and we'd cycle through all three cars in a 3-hour race.
Wow.
You know, and we had so much fun driving those things. And I think since there was a pause between when I drove them in competition last, which was the 90s, until, you know, we started driving them from like around 2002 to 2010 when Mark unfortunately passed away. But I think you got an appreciation, you know, having the opportunity to drive them again, and they were so much fun to drive, and they were well prepared, and sometimes we'd have first, second, or third. We'd be the one team would be on the roster on all three. We'd finish first, second, and third in the same race. It was a lot of fun.
Wow.
It was a great time. The Camel light cars were kind of easy to drive, and the Chevy V8 was a monster, you know. And we were turning times that were pretty good. Anyway, it was the golden era, as we said.
Well, the other thing that they had was there was a lot of sponsor money from Camel. Camel was intent on making it work. Their pre-sale in any area where we had the races, all the ancillary billboards and posters and handbills and all sorts of stuff that they did before, leading up to the event. I mean, it was Camel did a terrific job of ensuring that there were, you know, if you were even slightly interested in going to the racetrack, the way they promoted it, you were going to go. And
I agree. I mean, all the races we went to, there were big crowds. And
yep.
Now you look at the races they're putting on now, and it's they put them on for themselves and the TV audience.
Yeah, I understand at Laguna last weekend, that IMSA race had no more than 3,000 people in the stands.
Oh my God! Really?
Yeah, yeah. They said that there was no crowd at all. But those guys that are running that track now, one's a county employee, and they have really stumbled a little bit on that. They've just took it over from Scrap, I think about a year ago, and then the COVID. So this is the first time they've had to really start running it, and so I think that they're learning.
Jeez.
Well,
boy, that's
great. I don't know.
Wow.
I mean, we used to get a big crowd for the 24 hours, you know, I mean, in the infield, and it didn't look like there were many people there this year. Such is life, right? Kids are too busy playing video games.
Yeah.
Those damn kids nowadays, you know.
The dangers.
So.
Well,
you know, you
next?
Talk about.
Go ahead.
Yeah, Mitch, you got something for us?
I think Mitch left. He had to go pick up his daughter, he said.
Oh.
And we might actually wind this up. We're kind of running out of audience here. Everybody seems to be bailing out. So we could talk about this forever.
We're like an IMSA race. We're entertaining
you guys
ourselves.
You guys want to go to Siebkins?
Yeah, Siebkins.
Oh, man. Hey, I got one question for you guys. What about the John Paul event, I believe, is the Monday after
Long Beach.
Is that right?
Right.
I think it's,
right.
It's next, next Monday, isn't it? If I'm not
a week from this coming Monday.
Yeah.
That's right, because I'm going to Michigan on Sunday prior. Well, you guys have a good time. It's awfully good to hear your voices. I'm just shocked, Rob, on that last performance report that there was no gate per se at Laguna. You heard 3,000, huh?
I heard there was nobody there, and there was nobody there. But the guys that are running it, it's a different crowd. It's not Scramp.
Yeah.
It's not. They haven't built the gate equity in the place. They had a very thin crowd at the Historics. I was out there. I brought one of my cars that I collected, and then had another car on an old 27 Miller on the lawn at the Pebble Beach thing. And I was at both places, and the Pebble Beach was just jammed.
in storage. They had fewer cars, good cars, a lot fewer of them. And the crowd seems to be a little thin, but I don't know, this COVID, you know, it's keeping a lot of people under wraps.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, you know.
I don't know the reason either. So just we all got to stay healthy so we can talk about all this stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, part of this, well, you might have noticed, we're running this thing as long as we want to go. And I've kind of changed the format, so we're going to do one a month of some kind of IMSA topic. You guys will be back again when we talk about GTU or GTO. We're going to do a Le Mans show sometime before Monterey next year, which is Monterey, going to be Le Mans. And these are great stories. Glad that you're all here.
Well, we're honored to be here, and we're honored to have been able to participate in the races in those days, because it was a hell of an adventure, boy.
You got to get us, Dave, while we remember.
Yeah, we need to tell these stories before we're all gone and people lie about it.
They did already, can't you tell? Dave, have you been in contact with folks for our November show?
Not yet, no.
Okay. I'm just real curious about that.
Oh, yeah, that'll be a cool deal.
Yeah, I'm hoping to get all kinds of folks in on that one.
Oh,
that would be great.
Go ahead and wind up. So next month, a month from today, we're going to do IMSA-RS and have some of you guys back who drove an IMSA-RS beginning with 1971 of VIR and going on through the IS series when Jeff, I think, led every race in one of my cars, and then it blew up after 10 laps.
Yeah, well, so it's more important to lead.
I agree. Anybody have any questions out there? I see Decal's been hanging on there. Are you still there, Decal?
Yeah, I'm still here.
There.
Hey.
Decal.
How are you?
I am wonderful. I really enjoy listening to such great liars.
They're so good at it.
Yeah, you guys are amazing. All these years, you're still lying.
Well, you don't remember.
This is really a lot of fun. Yeah.
This guy got some blank cars last weekend. He was on the pit.
Yeah, I was up in Ohio. Doing champ car.
Whoa.
You all recovered from your operation?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. Yeah, they were amazed at how fast I recovered. Next up is my knee. I'm going to try to hit my right knee operating.
Well, you're like
ace with all the gasoline fumes.
Oh, I got a ton of those. Don't worry about that.
Decal, you're somebody ageless, you know? Decal, you're kind of ageless, because when you were 30, you looked 70, and now you're 70, you look 70. So
you
never change.
What's your secret?
Yeah.
All right, guys.
Lots of illegal chemicals being sprayed all over me.
Yeah.
I got to
go
get my
wife
a glass of
wine. My best to everybody.
All right.
Travel safe, everybody.
Talk to you, guys.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Okay, to confirm, our next episode will be Wednesday, October 20th at the usual time, 6 p.m. Pacific and 9 p.m. Eastern with IMSA-RS. And we're just beginning to gather up people. So if you know folks that were in RS that you think would enjoy being tortured in this way, send them our direction. And we'll put them out here in the ether.
Oh, we'll get some of these same guys back. I'm sure we can get Joe Vardy back, of course, and Amos Johnson. And
I can think of a bunch of them, yeah. Amos will be great.
Yeah, Jeff will be available, and Rick Knoop, of course, can talk about his win in that Concord or whatever it was at Talladega.
Oh, okay. Hey, you know what, you guys? What about Roger Mandeville? Has anyone talked to Roger and Nancy?
I've been planning to. I just haven't. You've got a phone number for them?
Yeah, I might have one right here. Hang on a second.
Yeah, I actually couldn't get a hold of Roger when I was writing my MCRS book, which ran out of pages anyway, but I've not talked to him in years.
I think that I know I talked to Nancy last year, and I don't know. I don't think Roger is driving anymore, but I don't want to be quoted on that. Let's see.
I covered all these guys when I wrote the book and pretty well got contact information there. So.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, then I won't. I-